I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Salish Sea is a spectacular ecosystem that goes up and down the coast here in and around Vancouver, into Washington State and through the Gulf Islands, down Vancouver Island and into the Pacific Ocean. From up here in British Columbia to the United States, its fauna, forests, and various species of fish and other mammals are gorgeous to behold and ecologically unique. A new book celebrates what can be found in this part of the world, up and down the Strait of Georgia, down to Puget Sound, and out into the Pacific through the Juan de Fuca Strait. The book is called The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. It celebrates the coastline and the thousands of square kilometers of sea surface, as well in dramatic photographs, the many species that can be found here. The book's authors Audrey Delella Benedict and Joseph K. Gatos narrate these photographs with a keen eye to history, the modifications to the region thanks to man and climate change, as well as how we can better protect this intricate marine ecosystem. Joe Gatos joins me now. He's a chief scientist for the Sea Doc Society, a marine science and conservation program focused on the Salish Sea. He's a licensed wildlife veterinarian with a PhD in wildlife health. The book is published by Sasquatch Books. Dr. Gatos joined me from here in Vancouver a few days ago while in town for events with the Vancouver Aquarium and the Georgia Strait Alliance. Please welcome to the Plant Online program Dr. Joe Gatos. Dr. Gatos, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So how did this book come about? Was it your idea or was it Audrey's?
That's a great question. I think it was a little bit of both of our ideas. I'd always dreamt about doing a book on the Salish Sea, and especially after the area was named in 2008 and 2009. But it was really Audrey who had the idea and came to me and said, have you ever thought about that? And I thought, Audrey, I think about it every day, but I don't know how to do a book. And she said, well, I have Cloud Ridge Publishing, and I've done books before, and she showed me an example of something they put out, and I thought, wow, that's magnificent. If we can do something half this beautiful, I'd be pleased, and I think we did.
It is a gorgeous book, and the photographs are wonderful. How long have you been living in this part of the world?
I moved here in 2001, so this summer will be 14 years for me.
Yeah, and where were you before, if I may ask?
I always tell people I was born a skinny white boy in the coal mining town in West Virginia.
I see.
This has been a great, but this is, I moved around a lot as a kid, and this is the longest I've ever lived in a place. This is definitely home for me.
Yeah, and there's nothing else anywhere like it, is there?
There really isn't. I mean, to be able to have this hugely productive inland sea right on the edge of these major metropolitan areas where people can just have that interface all the time, it's magic. I don't think there's another place like it.
Yeah, and you talk in the book about how the name Salish Sea came about. Who's responsible for that?
Well, I would say that if you had to pick one person, I would pick Bert Weber. He was a professor at Western Washington University. And the way he tells the story, he said in the 1970s, when people were interested in bringing in more crude oil from Alaska, scientists started studying the area. And they realized that whether you were in Olympia, Washington, or whether you were in Campbell River, B.C., it was really the same ecosystem. It had the same oceanic influences coming in from the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but there was no name for this place. And he proposed in the 1980s this name, the Salish Sea, in honor of the Coast Salish, who were here since time immemorial. Uh-huh. And the Geographic Board of Names at that time said, you know, it's a nice name, but nobody really uses it, so no thank you. And he just kept pushing it. And it wasn't until 2008 when the Coast Salish themselves, at one of their annual gatherings of tribes and First Nations, said, we are going to formally adopt this name. And then not long after that, the BC Board of Geographic Names and the Washington Board and the Canadian U.S. Federal Boards all adopted the name.
Yeah, it seems apt, and it's surprising in a way that it took so long.
Yeah, it really does when you look back. But I guess sometimes when you have a paradigm shift, it's so obvious. You think, why didn't we do that before? But the momentum just wasn't there.
Yeah, it's such a part of our identity, the sea, isn't it? I mean, not just in where I live here in Vancouver, where you live in Washington State. I mean, it is who we are, isn't it?
Oh, so much, Joe. I think if you stop to think about it, whether it's the food that you're eating or the views that you're looking or our weather, all of the things that that draw people to this place and that keep people in this place are all really tied to this inland sea.
Yeah, when you think of the just the numbers of species, as well as the uniqueness of the varied species that one finds here, as I said earlier, you can't find that anywhere else, can you?
No, you really can't. I mean, you think we have 37 mammals that depend on this place, 172 different bird species, 253 fish species, thousands and thousands of invertebrate species, and it's just all right there in our backyard.
What are the challenges that you're seeing today for the Salish Sea? I mean, is that people itself?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges is the awareness factor. I mean, it's all so much a part of our life, but on our day-to-day basis, we're concerned about traffic. We're concerned about our high school teenagers that are driving. We're concerned about the bank account. We forget that there's this ecosystem there that helps define us, gives us this high quality of life, and that we need to take care of it. And that was really a big goal in the book, is to try and remind people, this is really who we are, this is really important, and as a result, we need to take care of this place. And I think that awareness is really the first step to connecting and protecting the place.
Well, when you look at how we've done, say, in the last 10, 15 years, how are conservation efforts? Are they as dire as some people say they are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, we've had a lot of things going on in the last 10 or 15 years, but they're not as, we haven't gotten to the place where we can sit back and relax. And some people say, well, we're not getting anywhere. But the question is, what if we hadn't been doing all those things for the last decade or two? Mm-hmm. Where would we be now? We still have killer whales on the verge of extinction, but we have salmon populations that are coming back now, and we have fisheries that used to be closed that are now open. And so some things are going in the right direction, some things aren't. It's kind of like our own health. You think, I'm getting some weight off, but I still need to get my blood pressure down. So, there's all these metrics that we look at simultaneously. I just hope we keep going in the right direction.
So some of the things that aren't working, who's responsible for that? Are those the politicians themselves or who don't have the will, or is it, say, the public? Are we not there yet, say?
I think it's a little bit of both, because I think that, if the will is there, the politicians will bend. And so I think it's a part of us putting on enough pressure to say, this is important to us, and you need to pay attention to that. It's always easy to point the finger at somebody else, but my dad always says when I was a kid, look down, you've got three pointing right back at you, so see what you can do to make a difference.
Are there species that are particularly at risk at this point?
Yeah, there are. We do a study every 2 years to identify species that are threatened or endangered in the area, and we have quite a few. About one-third of the bird species are listed as threatened or endangered, and we have charismatic mammals that people resonate with, people like the southern resident killer whales that are endangered, and there are salmon runs that are endangered. So there are things that are really iconic that we need to do a better job taking care of.
What struck me in some of the photographs, Joe, are the eyes of some of the animals. I mean, some of them look scary, but some of them look particularly wise, whether they're bobcats or otters even.
Right, that's a really powerful observation, and I think what you're onto there, Joe, is that when you start to look into the eyes of some of these animals, you realize that they are complex. Just like our life is complex, their lives are complex. They have all of these things that they're worried about every day. That they don't worry about traffic like we do, but they're worried about where their next meal is coming from, what's happening with their kids, what's happening with their habitat. And when you start to think about it like that, you're kind of awestruck when you think of the thousands of different species out there that are living these really complex lifestyles.
Yeah, I don't know why it impressed me, but they just, they're resourceful animals, aren't they? Or mammals or whatever species they happen
right,
to be.
Right, their life depends on their powers of observation and planning and resourcefulness.
Yeah, some also don't look particularly attractive, like some of the ling cod.
Only a fisherman can love a mouth like that, right?
and some of those eels that hide in the
those wolf eels! Isn't that a great picture? And there's a male and a female. And you can tell the male because he's got these big, powerful jaws. And if you look very closely behind their heads, the little white dots that you see, those are their eggs, and they're actually in there protecting those eggs from predators.
Yeah, they look. I mean, you don't want to mess with them, do you?
No, definitely not. You don't want to stick your hand in there.
The other thing I found quite interesting were the species of rockfish, and you know, I've seen them say in restaurants. I didn't realize that they're quite old, or they could be quite old.
Oh, that's so true. I mean, we have about 26 different species of rockfish, and some of them, rough-eye rockfish, can live to be over 200 years old. That's phenomenal, and you want to be aware of that when you go in the restaurant, because nobody wants to eat something that's 200 years old.
Yeah, and are they, say, are they spikier? Are they more difficult to handle the older they are?
No, I think, I mean, they get bigger and they're more wise, but all of them, as a group of species, they're in the scorpionfish family. And so these spines that they have on their back and on their side fins, those are all have a poison at their base. You have to be careful when you're handling those guys.
Yeah, I've seen them at fish markets and the sort, say in Chinatown, and they do look dangerous to handle even.
Yeah, they will. And just next time you look at them, Joe, think of that name, scorpionfish. You'll be more careful.
Exactly, yeah. We've mentioned salmon already. You mentioned some of these salmon runs that are in danger. That's the species, I think, that defines the Salish Sea, isn't it?
I would say definitely. If you had to pick one group, I would say the salmon would be the group that you would pick that really defines it. They have salmon in other parts of the world, and in Alaska and places like that, but really we're at this southernmost latitude. We're at the edge of having all of these salmon together, and they're just a critical component of the ecosystem.
Now, you mentioned that some of the runs are in danger. Is that overfishing? Is that what we've done to the environment? What are the challenges there?
Yeah, so the salmon biologists will tell you there's usually, when you talk about problems with salmon, there are these four H's, and one of them is harvest, like you said, overfishing. One of them is habitat. We've changed the rivers and streams. One of them is hydroelectric. We put in these big dams. And then the fourth one are hatcheries. We didn't do anybody any favors when we started to put hatcheries out there because we thought we could mitigate for all of the other damages if we just put more fish out there. And what we're realizing over and over and over again is that we can do these hatcheries, but we really can't compete with Mother Nature. The ones that come out of the wild, they live longer, they're more hardy. It's just hard for us to compete.
And in hatcheries, that includes, say, fish farms, is that right? Or are they the same thing?
That's a good question. We should talk to those salmon biologists about putting another H in there, and it would have to be a silent H, maybe with a schwa P for fish farms. And but that's something that's come in later in the game, and there are more and more data showing up that make people concerned about, especially with some of the disease aspects. People are concerned about some of the parasites and things like that. That's a fifth one. Thanks for bringing that up.
Now, the changes that have been wrought by man have obviously altered the sea a great deal. But what have you found in your research as to how it's perhaps still the same from, say, millions of years ago? I mean, you talk in the book about some of the rock formations of sediment and just how old this place is.
Yeah, I think that the real changes, you know, so, and Audrey is the geologist, she would tell you, have happened in the last 1.8 million years. And even in the last 10 or 15,000 years, you know, this place was covered, much of this was covered in these big sheets of ice. And that ice receded and kind of opened up what we know today. So the, you know, relatively speaking on a geologic scale, this place is newer than some areas. But I think all of the formations and the rocks and things like that probably look very similar to when those glaciers receded.
Hmm. And you could, I guess you do a lot of diving.
I love it.
You see that you must see the damage that we've done.
You know, you don't see as much of that underwater. I think we're doing a better job. You still sometimes will find derelict fishing nets and things like that, but they're good programs that are happening to get those out of the water. And I don't see the changes. Like, I was diving one time off of West Africa, and just the amount of trash that were on the reefs there was phenomenal to me. And we just don't see as much of that. You'll see the occasional wreck or something like that. But underwater, the changes are not as obvious as they are above on land.
And in terms of, say, salt versus freshwater, I mean, if you had to break it down in percentages, how much freshwater is there in the Salish Sea, in and around the Salish Sea?
Right, right. So the whole, by definition, this whole area is an estuary. So we have this complex mixing of this salt water and fresh water. And depending on the time of the year and where you are, it may, you know, if you're at the mouth of the Fraser in the springtime when the snow is melting off, that's going to be like fresh water. You know, if you're at the Strait of Juan de Fuca in the late summer when there's not going to be much fresh water, that's going to be more like salt water. So the whole area has this complex mixture, and that's one of the things that makes it so darn productive.
And you're speaking from Vancouver today. How have you found say the relations between Canada and the U.S. with regards to what each country does? And how that affects the Salish Sea, because what we do in with our waters on this coast, I mean, certainly affects what happens as it goes south and vice versa.
Oh yeah, we're intimately connected, and I would say on the personal level, we're all in this together. Politically, we need to be doing a much better job of trying to coordinate things between the U.S. and the Canadians and the First Nations and the tribes who are also independent government bodies that are working towards the same thing. So I would say we could do a lot better, and fortunately the naming of this area, the Salish Sea, having one name, it does help to unify us, and I think eventually we'll help get the governments on board as well.
Now, the photographs on the book, they're done, I guess, by different photographers, are they?
Right. We have 55 different photographers in the book. Just an amazing assortment. About 230 some photographs. We looked at about 6,000 photographs just to select these 230 some.
Wow. I mean, as I said earlier, they're just gorgeous photographs.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then the beauty of most of these photographs is it's not like an identification book where you say, oh, this is a yellow-eyed rockfish. You look at these, and each picture is telling you a story about this animal or about this place or about the geology or about the flow of water. They're all like mini stories.
Is there a species that you encountered along the way in your diving and your work and the sort that is particularly frightening?
I heard a great story the other day from a biologist who's a pretty famous guy. He's been studying subtitle ecology for over 40 years now, and he told me a story of when they first started diving back in the 1960s. He said they didn't even have gauges that told them when they ran out of air. They would just run out, and then they would start ascending. And he said they would go up 10 feet, and you'd get another breath, and 10 feet, get another breath, and that's just the way they did it. He said one time he was down finishing his transect, doing some counting, and just as he ran out of air, a giant Pacific octopus descended right on his neck. Hmm. And he said the funny thing was he was most worried about this thing biting him in the back of the neck. They have a little beak. And he said he tried to get off of it, and it just squeezed him. And he thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to drown down here. And so he said he just relaxed. He relaxed his legs and pushed off. And as he started going up, the octopus let go. And just, he said, it peeked around, and with its big eye kind of just, he said, I had this contact, this eye-to-eye contact. I know we had interspecies communication. And I said, yeah, Paul, that or you are really out of air. And your brain wasn't working. But whichever it was, it's still a pretty neat story.
Well, that's the thing that this book has done for me. It's made me notice the eyes of these species, these different animals and the sort.
Right, right.
You know, and made me realize just how interconnected we are. I guess that's the message of the book, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And we're a part of the ecosystem. It's not like we're just visitors watching. We're an integral part of the whole thing.
Yeah, congratulations on this book, Joe. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's a fine achievement, this book.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe. It was great to talk with you today.
The same. Dr. Joe Gatos with Audrey Delella Benedict wrote The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest. It's published by Sasquatch Books. Dr. Gatos, join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.